And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome Ann Patchett back to the program today. Ann has written several books of nonfiction, including 2013's This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. But she's best known for her novels, including Bel Canto, which won the Penn Faulkner and Orange Prizes, and 2012's State of Wonder. Today we'll be talking about her latest novel, Commonwealth, which was recently released in paperback. When we last spoke about your essay collection, you said you were getting ready to write a Romana Clay. Did Commonwealth turn out like you thought it would be at the beginning of the process?
It did, actually. The beginning of the process being the beginning of the process of writing as opposed to the beginning of the process of thinking. So when I first am thinking about a book, things can change a lot. But when I actually start writing, things are pretty close to how I think they're going to go.
No, I was actually struck by how similar, structurally, Commonwealth and This is the Story of a Happy Marriage were.
Really?
Right. Is more episodic in nature, shifting timelines, the reader knowing more than the participants at times.
Well, that's interesting. I've never thought about that because This is the Story of a Happy Marriage is nonfiction and it's essays. So all of those pieces were written discreetly over a long period of time and then shuffled around and put together, whereas Commonwealth was written in one shot and written in the order that you read it in.
So did you have an idea of everyone's biography that's in the story? It's a fairly large cast of people and how they would progress through the years, or did you just come to a point and say, oh, this is, then have to think about how their life was before this point that's later on?
I knew most of it. I mean, certainly there were a lot of things that I learned along the way. Specific details of scenes I would learn along the way. But for example, I knew in the second chapter of Commonwealth that we would then be picking up the story in the first chapter in which Franny is a baby. Now Franny would be 50. Now her father, who she hadn't grown up with, would be old. I knew he would be very ill and dying, but I didn't know where they would be having that conversation or what his illness was. So I did know everybody was going to have their moment and what order in which they would have that moment, but I wouldn't know the specifics of it.
At any point, were you surprised when something would come up? Did anything ever throw you off your course?
No. I don't know why people always are a little disappointed when I say that, but I do really get it pretty well outlined. And again, there were a lot of places I changed my mind, but I changed my mind mostly in the planning and not in the writing.
I can't remember who it was, but it was some old lion expressed a distaste for authors who get surprised by their characters.
That might have been me, actually. Yeah, I say that all the time. I mean, people love that magical idea of the characters taking over. And everywhere I go, somebody asks me that question. The characters write the book. Do you feel like you're just typing it up? You know, do they just hijack the plot? And I think, no, you know, this is my job and I'm building a house and I have a plan. I have a set of plans and I know the order in which I have to take the house up. You don't build the second story and then you build the basement. So it happens in a pretty structured way for me.
So do you believe there is magic in art at all?
I believe there is magic in art. I just don't necessarily believe there's magic in my art.
But if we look at what we call magic, like Penn and Teller or David Copperfield or someone like that, illusionists,
yes,
there is a lot of hard work involved in that.
Absolutely. And there is no magic whatsoever for Penn and Teller or David Copperfield. It is acting and carpentry and illusion. There is not an act of magic taking place. Magic is misdirection and props.
I actually took a writing workshop, and they encouraged us to read us a manual on stage magic.
Oh.
In which I remember the magician said that if you can find a card in a card trick one way, but you can present it in 50 different manners, you have 50 tricks. If you can find a card 50 different ways but can only present it one way, you have one trick.
I like that. That's very good. I've become really good friends with a magician in the past few years, a guy named Ben Whiting who lives in Michigan. And it's a very funny story, but he was at Parnassus one day and he saw my dog Sparky and realized that he had the same dog. And so he sent me a picture of his dog and we began to write. And now he and his wife and his dog come and visit, and he does magic on cruise ships. And so they will drive down here and leave their dog Scooter off for 6 weeks at a time while they go off on the ship. And I have learned a lot from him in our discussions about fiction writing and magic. And my belief that it's all about authority. It's all about, in a way, having your reader or the person in the audience believe what you're telling them, even as they're fighting you, even as they're really looking hard to see you slip up. It's kind of about domination in a way.
Now, with Bel Canto being about opera and you having the magician friend, what is it about the performative arts do you think have in common with literature?
That's an interesting question. I think it's about the ability to take on characters and personas and to fully inhabit someone else who's not you. And I know Alan Alda. Alan Alda is a friend of mine, and he writes a lot and talks a lot about using the techniques of acting to relay scientific and medical information. And I said to him, if I had my education to do over again, I would take nothing but acting classes. I would have gone to straight theater school and learned to be an actress, because the very little acting I did has served me more than anything else I ever studied, both in terms of presenting myself on stage, which I do a lot, but also in terms of developing characters and roles.
I spoke with a debut author this year, Chanel Benz, had a wonderful collection of short stories, and she said that inhabiting the characters is much easier after you've been through the training of acting.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes I even think about dropping out of my life for a year and taking acting classes. Would be interesting.
Which school of acting do you think you would be prone to study?
It's funny. I have no idea. I don't know enough about different schools of acting to say that I would do this or that.
Well, which plays appeal to you would you like to be in?
I do love those Chekhov plays. I love Ibsen. I love Eugene O'Neill. It's funny. I used to really read plays. I have seen comparatively few plays, but I'll read them, which is weird. Who reads plays? It'd be better to spend more time in a theater.
But that would be really good training for dialogue writing.
Yeah, no, it's true. Absolutely. Although the best training for dialogue writing that I ever got was in my 20s, I used to date a DA, a prosecutor in New York, and he would have to read wiretaps, and it would be thousands of pages of some drug dealer's girlfriend talking to her mother on the phone about the soap opera they were just both watching. And you realize dialogue is not conversation. Dialogue is something else entirely. It's being able to distill a moment and a half a sentence to convey a lot of information.
I think conversation would come across as word salad without the context. And
it's just boring. I mean, people are really boring and inarticulate, and they go on forever. And it's one thing to listen to them, but if you read them, it's excruciating.
Especially if they're president of the United States.
Absolutely.
Now, last night, a thunderstorm rolled through Memphis. And this is going to sound very odd and goofy, but there was a stroke of lightning. And as the sky lit up, I thought about how the story is episodic in nature for Commonwealth, and that made me think of the wave-particle duality of light.
Gosh.
And so I thought of the episodes as the photons and the novel as the wavelength.
Wow. Thank you for applying that knowledge to fiction, my fiction.
As I said, it was weird, but it seems that the last time we spoke, you talked about how so much of writing is what not to include.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about the episodic nature of this story. Even a novel that has a plot that's just one long scene still leaves a lot of information out in that process.
Yes.
And that all stories are episodic in their way. How we represent a whole from these episodes is seems very interesting to me at the moment.
Well, I have often thought if there's anything to admire about Commonwealth, admire my discretion, because it could have been an 800-page novel and it could have been a 1,200-page novel. It is a book that really could go in any direction. And in the final chapter where Franny goes to a Christmas party and there is a whole new set of siblings and steps and in-laws, and I kept thinking, oh, I could write their stories. These people could also have chapters and they could be really interesting chapters. But the act of holding myself back and constantly thinking, how much information does the reader really need to have? And I think about that a lot. I've read some really episodic novels lately. Underground Railroad, Colson Whitehead. That was a fantastic novel that could have been 200 pages and it could have been 2,000 pages. She could have just kept coming up into different cities and having completely different experiences. The 12 Lives of Samuel Hawley, which was a Hannah Tinty novel, could have been the 6 Lives of Samuel Hawley, and it could have been the 16 Lives of Samuel Hawley. And that question, at what point does the reader have enough information to take the story forward without the author? And that's the point at which I want to stop.
Then the decisions on what to keep away from us all throughout that time.
Sure, but that's exactly part of it. What do you tell? Whose storyline do you follow? There's mention of a car accident in Commonwealth, that Franny was in a car accident when she was in high school and that it was her fault and she was drinking and no one else was hurt and she wasn't hurt. And that's all we know. And we never come around to it. We never see that car accident. But when I was out on tour, it seemed like every night somebody said, why didn't you ever tell us what happened in that car accident? And I think, do some work. You know, like, what more do you need to know? I can leave that out. You've got enough information. I don't have to show you the scene for you to know what the impact of it was.
Throughout the book, there's a major tragedy that happens that's first alluded to and then slowly gain more knowledge of what had actually happened. So with the timeline switching back and forth, we do have some knowledge of the character's life before they gain it when we're going to the flashbacks. Mm-hmm. But then there's this important bit of information that has radically affected so many of the people in the novel that's been withheld from us.
Right.
And so there's this weird tension of, we know more about you than you do, but then again, there's a part of yourself that we don't have access to yet.
Right. Life. I mean, I think that there's some real pleasure in that. The book that I wrote, Run, was a book where I really played with that. And at the end of the book, you know things that no character in the book knows. So it's not that it's withheld. I mean, no one has all the pieces except the reader. And I found that just thrilling because it seemed like such a great way to involve the reader, to make her a repository of these facts. So that reader is putting the puzzle together in a way that the characters never could because they don't have all the information the reader has. It's just something that I enjoy. It's funny how that works. You learn how to do something in one novel and it's hard. And then you think, oh, God, this is great. I've got this down now. I'm going to move this forward into the next book.
Was there a new tool or technique that you were able to use in writing Commonwealth?
It takes place over such a large period of time, and that I really was thinking, how do you cover such a large period of time and so many characters without it feeling thin? And so I thought if I did straight chronology, the reader would really feel the big gulfs in between the action. But if I skip around a little, and the book essentially moves forward. It's like it takes 2 steps forward or 3 steps forward and 1 step back. You know, you're generally speaking heading into the future, but with some lapses back into the past. That by doing that, you don't have as much of a sense of the holes and everything that I'm leaving out. Because what I'm trying to do is really bore down in a very deep and specific way into several moments, as opposed to saying, okay, I'm going to show you what their life looked like. I'm just going to show you with intensity what a few moments of their life look like.
And also, I think some of the choices you made for the characters, like Holly living in a Buddhist retreat in Switzerland, Jeanette marrying a man from Africa, Albie living the life of a drifter for so much time, those things inspire so much more imagination and thinking than if they had lived a more quotidian life in suburban America.
Yes, I think that that's very true. And I also did that because the characters are loosely based on people from my own life. In a way, I didn't want to stick to the actual narrative of their lives. And so for each person, I thought about the life I would have wished for them. And I think that the lives we wish for people are always a little more creative and interesting than the lives that they wind up with.
Now, Franny is our most central character in the book, and we get to see parts of her life that are outside of the family. But it seems when we see the other characters, even later in life, if someone who is not Franny pops up, fairly soon another part of the family is going to be connected to them in some way in their stories, it seems like.
That's interesting. I hadn't really thought about that, because the way in which you see Franny is romantically, basically. You know, you see her with Leo Posen, who she has a long affair with when she's young, and then later you see her with her husband. But it's true with the other characters. No, I never thought about that. You are seeing them in relation to other characters, other members of the family. Why is that? I have no idea.
I guess for economy's sake.
Sure.
I mean, you have to address most of the characters, so to bring them together.
Again, it could have been an 1,800-page novel. It could have been a most suitable boy.
Things are a bit meta in that there is a book inside of Commonwealth named Commonwealth, another novel.
And a movie of that book, yes.
And it is also real-life personal family stories, albeit told by another person with access to them. Was that a way for you to address your own concerns about including real life details in your book, is to kind of spin it out and see how it would go forward?
Yes. Yes. And to kind of explore the worst case scenario, the scenario in which people are hurt and angry and in which control is lost and people feel that they're not even victimized by the novelist. By the time the movie comes around, he's dead. It's just out of their control. And these were the things that I was worried about. And so by including them in the novel, I really got to think them through. It's not like I thought this was what was going to happen, but it's kind of like This Is a Wonderful Life. It's the great thing about writing a novel is you get to play out the opposite scenarios. It's not so much what happened, it's what you worry about happening. I interviewed Zadie Smith when she was here, and she was saying, somebody asked her a question about autobiography, and she said, well, I'm not the main character. I'm more like the mother of the main character. And it's not that I am like her. It's that she's the kind of mother I'm afraid of being. And I thought, oh yeah, that's exactly right. You know, like, the way it's autobiographical is that this is the thing I'm afraid of happening, not the thing that is actually happening.
On a side note, I had attempted to join the Foreign Service, and I just did miss achieving that goal. I'm 0.05 off on the test. And so then I started to write my autobiography as if I had gotten the job, and what all horrible things would have happened to me.
Exactly right. That is, in a way, the best use of fiction, or one of the great uses of fiction. And I think that I could look at any of my books and say, I'm playing out some part of my life that I'm worried about, something that is almost the dream life, where you slip into a world you can't quite get out of, but it is still your world.
Well, what's worrying you right now?
What is worrying me right now? Trump. And I know that the book that I'm just starting now has a lot to do with that. It's about a woman who is really choking on money and possessions, and that everything in the country seems to praise wealth, and she can't bear it. She literally cannot bear it. And so, yeah, that's sort of the dark side of what keeps me up right now.
In regards to our political situation, do you think artists have a role beyond their role as citizen in addressing things?
Absolutely. Historically, it doesn't mean that every artist has to, but I think that artists tend to be good at holding up a mirror to society in different ways, showing what's possible to be better, but also showing the ugliest parts of ourselves as a cautionary tale. And that's one of the great privileges of making art.
Who's going to be the Harriet Beecher Stowe of our time?
Who's going to be the Harriet Beecher Stowe of our time? That's interesting. I sure think Coulson could do it because he has humor and brutality and a cool detachment and a huge intelligence, all of those things coming together. And when I think about all of his books, my favorite book of his was his first book, and I have to say,
The Intuitionist.
I do so hate it when people say, my favorite book of yours is Patron Saint of Liars. And if Coulson was here, I would not say my favorite book of yours is The Intuitionist. But that's an incredible book. I mean, that's a book that makes me think he's really writing about a political situation and about conspiracy and cover-up and cliques and factions and all of those things.
Back with the autobiographical, the Romano Clay aspect of it, and you played out the worst possible scenario in the book.
And the best, too, because I gave people better lives.
How has the reaction been from your family toward the book?
It's really been fine. I mean, I talked to them about it before I started, while I was writing it, when I was finished. I gave everybody a draft as soon as I had finished, before I had really done much editing, you know, and said, does anybody have any problems? One person in my family didn't like the book, but was really, really nice to me about it and just kind of said nothing about it. Everybody else said, boy, this was uncomfortable, but it's your best book and we love you and we're proud of you. I think that everybody had a little bit of a PTSD experience from the book, but they were really positive and supportive and sweet about it. One of my stepsisters said some friend of hers had read the book and she called me very excitedly and she said, and she knew which character was me. She knew which one I was playing. And I was like, seriously? That would be so obvious to anyone who knew you at all.
Was that Mean Caroline?
No, actually.
I have to say, when I started to read the book, I tried as hard as possible to forget that Ann Patchett existed.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to read the book on its own. And I think most of that was laziness on my part because I didn't want to have to reread This is the Story of a Happy Marriage and have to go through and try to figure things out. I just wanted to experience the story.
I appreciate that. And I think the people that I meet who do have problems with it, I think there aren't that many people who know me. I was out in Southern California last week and I did a fundraiser for my stepmother's library. And there were a lot of people. It's a little tiny town in Southern California. And there were a lot of people in that room who knew me, who knew my dad, who knew my stepmother. And there were a lot of questions about autobiography and, you know, people saying, oh, I was really trying to figure out what was true and what happened and what didn't happen. And I was like, yeah, you know what? This is a really rarefied little bunch and I'm not actually worried about you guys at all. I mean, I think that for the vast majority of people who read the book, they're not going to have to be parsing out aspects of my life.
And there are a nice number of jokes in the book, too.
Good.
I mean, I laughed quite a bit while I was reading.
Good. I always think my books are funny. I think Bel Canto is a hysterically funny book, but they're getting closer to the surface, I guess.
One of the reactions in the book to the movie was when Fix, Franny and Caroline's father, goes to see the movie. And up until that point, he had been pretty much a sanguine fellow. Even in the recounting of his partner's death, it didn't seem, he seemed kind of removed from it, that it wasn't affecting him emotionally, but just the explosion that happens when he sees the movie. I appreciated Fix really getting to have a moment.
Oh, good, good. Yeah, because, you know, with Lomer's death, that's something that he has been dealing with. I mean, so actively dealing with. And he's gotten to a place now where he can make a story out of it. That's a really important setup, that whole scene about his partner's death at the beginning of the book, because it is about somebody who's saying, this bad thing happened a long time ago. This bad thing that happened a long time ago is much worse than anything that's going to happen in this novel. And it derailed this character for years, but he got past it. And I kind of want the reader to know, whatever happens, these people got past it and they're okay. And it didn't define every moment of their life. But when Fix goes and sees this movie, and he's never read the book, and he doesn't know what's coming, it shocks him and enrages him and throws him back into direct confrontation with something that he's gotten past. And he just explodes. And yeah, it was great. It was great to let him get that mad.
Early on the book, the very first chapter is about Franny's christening party.
Mm-hmm.
And since I grew up missionary Baptist, that's not in our tradition. And drinking definitely wasn't. So just the concept of promising this young child to the higher power and then getting liquored up in the process just always struck me as such a strange thing.
Well, most christening parties don't go that way, of course. But I'm sure a few of them do, just by virtue of the fact that they're, you know, usually right after Mass at 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning. So probably a lot of them don't end up in drunken debauchery, but it was a nice idea. It was fun to think about.
Well, from the ones that we see in movies and such, they almost always tend to turn out that way. So
oh, do they?
Well, people seem to want that out of
okay.
a party.
All right. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. I'm thinking about The Godfather now, the christening party in The Godfather. I guess that's pretty serious.
And also, I was thinking about the parenting, and I had read, I'm drawing a blank on who did it for the New York Times, who reviewed your book for the New York Times.
Curtis Sittenfeld.
That's right. And how she talked about, she had read the helicopter parenting aspect of it a bit wrong in the story. And I was thinking about how, what was unique about this generation of parents? If, you know, we go back to Philip Larkin, we're just doomed to screw up our kids.
Right.
What do you think was unique about that generation of parents and how they screwed up their kids?
Well, it's funny because people say to me all the time, oh, these parents were so terrible. They were just so awful. And I never meant for them to be bad parents. This is just the way parents were in the 70s, in the 60s. You know, we were free-range kids and the parents were living adult lives. I can remember my mother, who I loved and I think was a really good mother in many ways. But when we were kids, we would say, come on and play Monopoly with us. And she would say, well, that's a children's game. Adults don't play children's games. Why would an adult want to play Tea Party? Why would an adult want to play with dolls? You know, that's great. That's your stuff. I've got my stuff. And I think that that's such a difference now. Not only do parents keep an eye on their children all the time, but they get down on the floor and pretend to be children. And certainly, not only did my parents never do anything like that, but the parents of my friends didn't do that either. We had very separate lives, and we didn't know what they were doing, and they didn't know what we were doing, and we didn't really care what the other one was doing. You just went out in the morning, and you entertained yourself. You didn't come in and ask anybody to entertain you. If you came in too early, they sent you back outside. If you came in too late, maybe somebody would go looking for you. But that was it. We just weren't so involved with one another as parents and children seem to be now.
I've thought about, is it because we have fewer kids nowadays, or is it because people are having kids later, and so their grandparently feelings are being confused with their level of hormones, as opposed to having a child when you're 22, having a child when you're 37, normally that's, you're starting to look at grandparenthood at that time in the past.
Yeah, that's a very interesting idea. Also, there doesn't seem to be fear anymore. We had such a sense of authority and a fear of authority. We were afraid of the principal. We were afraid of our teachers. We were afraid of police officers. We respected these people. Even if we weren't doing anything wrong, you know, you stood up straighter, you got quiet. And we were afraid of our parents. You know, there was a chair that was your dad's chair. You didn't sit in that chair. And now I feel like there isn't the dad's chair anymore. You know, there's not that sense of, well, I'm an adult and this is mine. That seems to be gone. So this book really takes place in that world that doesn't exist. Somebody asked me recently at an event about how I felt about Updike and Bellow and Roth and those writers and what their place was now and if people still read them. And I was saying every single thing in life is fashion. And how we raise our children is fashion. How we manage our health and what we eat and how we decorate our homes and how we build our homes and how we write books and certainly politics. Every single thing goes through fashion. And one of the wonderful things about fiction is that it preserves the fashion of the time and makes a time capsule constantly. And I find this so much now that I own a bookstore and I read contemporary fiction constantly. I read the books that haven't been published yet. And I read them not the way I used to read books to help me as a writer or to be entertained or to be edified. I really read novels now the way I read the newspaper. I read them to see what the fashion is and to see them as a reflection of our time.
And how does it feel to read that way instead of reading for edification or pleasure?
I feel very fortunate that I'm having this experience at this point in my life, because if it wasn't for the bookstore, I never would have changed the way that I read. I never would have read as widely and weirdly as I read now. I just read all over the map now. And I'm much less critical, because there used to be, if I didn't like a book, I didn't like a book. Wasn't a good book, I didn't like a book. Now I read books and I think, well, this isn't for me. This isn't my taste. But it's much easier for me to see this is a good book. And I bet Kathy would really like this book. I bet Karen would really. This is a book I want to give to Nikki. It's fine if I don't like it. I don't have to like it. And that change in thinking really allows me to learn a lot about not only the literature that's being written, but about the world around me. Because it used to be, you know, if I was reading a book and I didn't like it, I just stopped reading it. And believe you me, I still stop reading plenty of books that I don't like. But it's a very different experience.
So you think more about the effectiveness that a book has?
Yes.
Ability to connect with its target reader?
Well, and I think who is the target reader? And I think, who would I want to recommend this book to? Even if it's a book that didn't work for me, I can really understand how somebody walking in saying, I really want a book that makes me laugh and be happy at the end. Well, you know, I could maybe think of five other books that do a better job at it. But this book is going to make you laugh and it's going to make you happy at the end. So this is a good book. I've got a place for this book in my mind. So when somebody asks for this kind of book, I'll have it. And people really do ask for certain kinds of books that will make them feel the way this other book that they loved made them feel.
Which book recently did you find effective that most people would not think that perhaps Ann Patchett might find this book effective?
The book that I'm reading right now is by Dorothea Benton Frank, and it's called All the Single Ladies. This is a book I never would have read. Dorothea Benton Frank is an extremely popular author of light women's fiction. She writes a book a year, and she's come to the store a couple of times, and I like her tremendously. We have become friends. I respect her. I think she's smart, funny. She's read all my books. I haven't read any of her books, because she writes the kind of book I don't read. And that makes me a jerk. And so she was here recently and she was talking about every single book I had written. And I thought, this is really bad. So what if there are women with parasols and swimsuits and cocktails on the cover of her books? I need to buckle down and read one just to be a decent friend. And you know what? It's great. It's fast. It's funny. It's smart. It's sassy. It is not my kind of book. It is not the kind of thing that I would ever read, but it is a well-oiled machine and it's well done. And there are people who come in and they want exactly this kind of book, and I would wholeheartedly recommend it.
And also, y'all have in common that you're extremely hard workers, because I saw her tour for coming up for the book, and she's hitting two cities a day.
Not only that, she tours every year. You know, she, this is like, not only does she write a book every year, she goes out and meets all of her fans and is on boards and panels and interviewing other people. She's a solid citizen.
Well, what has your turn as a solid citizen been like since your public profile is raised so much in Nashville?
I like being a solid citizen. It takes a lot of time. It's absolutely been worth it. I love promoting Parnassus, but then all the different places that it's taken me to promoting independent bookstores in general, all over the country, to promoting what we can do for young writers and first-time writers, to becoming the ambassador for the Book Industry Charitable Foundation, which gives emergency grants to people who work in bookstores. I now am raising money for that. So there are just all sorts of different things that I never in a million years thought I would be involved with, because I have been so stretched, and stretched in a good way, by owning the bookstore. But one of the things that it's really made me think about is my capital, and that by writing books for a long period of time that people like, I have built up capital. And so when I say at the end of an event where there are 1,000 people in the audience, hey, guys, if you like having an independent bookstore in your town, you need to support it. It's up to you. It's your responsibility. You make that decision if that store lives or dies. When I do those things, I'm spending my capital. If I am recommending a book or really throwing my weight behind an author, saying, okay, I've built up credibility. Now I'm going to put it into this project. And it's really made me think a lot about where I want to spend the rest of the capital that I have, how I want to build it and how I want to spend it. Because I think that a lot of people just build it and save it and don't spend it. So I'm really interested in voting. And the next big project I'm going to get involved with after I finish this novel is a book about voting and women getting the vote. You could chart a direct line from opening the bookstore and what I learned about public opinion and being able to impact public opinion. Well, wow, if I can impact public opinion on books and authors and book selling and the publishing industry, what else would I want to impact public opinion about? I would really want to urge people to vote. Not to vote the way I vote, but to vote. That seems like a great use of capital.
And it's a shame that it's not your next book, because isn't the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment coming up in a couple of years?
The next book will come out in May of 2020 for the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment in August of 2020. That's exactly what it'll do. It'll be a short nonfiction book, but it will come out after the novel.
Well, Anne, I want to thank you so much for taking a few minutes out and speaking with me today. It's been a pleasure.
It's been so nice. Thanks for coming to the house.
Anne Patchett is the author of Commonwealth, which is now available in paperback from Harper Perennial. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.